Studies in Foreign Policy, The Origins of Collective Security, Part 2, a podcast from Crowd Talks.
Welcome back to Part 2 of Studies in Foreign Policy, Collective Security. As you will recall, this podcast follows on from Part 1, and in Part 1, we discussed the historical origins of collective security and how they grew out of the First World War. We also heard in that podcast how the American President Woodrow Wilson became the prime international advocate for an international peace organization called the League of Nations. We commence our podcast today with the events of the Versailles Peace Conference, done and dusted, and the membership of the new body ready to meet for the first time. So let's begin. The first supranational institution in history to address international disputes met at Geneva in its new headquarters on the 5th of November 1920. The circumstances could not have looked any less auspicious. Two key powerful nations were simply excluded. The Germans and the Russians didn't get an invite because they were not members and were persona non grata. Germany, because they had been defeated by the Allies, and Russia, because they were now a communist regime. Its founding advocate, the United States of America, didn't turn up either because it did not join. What happened? As you will recall from the last part of the podcast, the United States and its president was at the center of efforts to create this new League of Nations. And the United States jilts the bride at the altar and doesn't join. If this is your first exposure to these events in US history, the following short summary will assist in filling out that gap between the final agreement to the Covenant and Paris and the League sitting down in Geneva in 1920 to meet. What happens when Wilson returns back to the United States? In the United States Constitution, treaties like the League of Nations membership in the Versailles Treaty, they don't take legal effect until the United States Senate ratifies the treaty. It has one of these peculiar constitutional powers where it has to approve that treaty before the United States can be legally bound to it. When Wilson returns to the United States from Paris with the treaties in hand, there was an immediate opposition to the League, which had been building for months while he was in Paris. The epicenter of it was within the Republican Party. There were a number of questions like how US sovereignty would work within the League. And in the Senate, Wilson's enemies lay in wait to basically mug Wilson and the League proposal. Wilson, instead of really reaching out to the Republican Party to try and accommodate his opponents, decides to take his campaign for the League to the public, and he embarks upon a speaking tour, vastly overrating his persuasive skills, and also managing to give himself a stroke in the process. He's evacuated back to Washington, laid up in bed, where he attempts to manage the League fight within the Senate with a great lack of success, I might add. It's appropriate, though, to also mention that he spurned all reasonable compromises in regard to the League proposal. And in fact, in complete fairness to the Republican Party, at no point did Wilson ever bring the Republicans inside the tent, so to speak, right from the get-go. None were invited to Paris to provide any input, And by the time we have a fight in the Senate, Wilson is in no state of mind to be seeking any compromise. The Republican Party at this point was quite willing to offer compromises in regards to America's membership of the League, but they were not to be accommodated, and America's membership of the League is defeated in the Senate. At this point, Woodrow Wilson passes out of our story. The League of Nations now commences its work. Now, how did it progress? Despite the monumental blow of three great powers not participating in it, which, in my view, denied the League critical early momentum to do its work, it did, in fact, though, get to work in these less than auspicious circumstances. During the 1920s, it addressed a number of quite tricky territorial disputes that did beset post-war affairs. There were other successes, but where it really meant to count, which is in the area of security, it only had failures over the preceding two decades. Why did it fail? I borrow heavily here in some respects from Paul Kennedy's 2006 book, The Parliament of Man, to guide the discussion. Kennedy starts by saying that the international environment post-war was probably too adverse to the creation of a collaborative body. There was all manner of toxicity besetting the nations, massive financial debt amongst them, the outbreak of revolutions, and really serious social unrest, not just in Europe, but across the globe. And this all had profound social, economic, and political effects. That's not to mention either that collective security was already controversial even within countries that were superficially supportive of the idea. These critics had deep reservations over the practicability of international organisations. Winston Churchill was a big critic of collective security. The Abyssinia crisis, which we will mention shortly, seemed to confirm to these critics that these international organisations can only work when the powers are motivated by their own interests and they agree to take action in pursuit of them. Some of these critics preferred a more traditional balance of power approach to international problems, and that was like Churchill himself. But this was also difficult in the post-war period because there was this massive dislocation of the balance of power. I mean, how could you approach things from a balance of power perspective when the great powers basically did not even talk at levels where you needed to have a balance of power mechanism develop? The United States just shut itself off. None of the allies or ex-allies wanted to talk with Germany, and absolutely no one wanted to talk with Soviet Russia. But getting back to collective security itself, the absence of the United States throughout the 20s and 30s was really problematic, and you had structural problems concerning the prime objective of maximising security occurring within the League itself. And this mainly arose from the unbalanced nature of the League membership and other various flaws in the covenant that didn't compel member states to take economical military actions against an aggressor. It's no coincidence the powers who were the most disgruntled by the post-war settlement would cause the League the most difficulty in the future. Some of them had adverse characteristics that contributed to their poor outlook on the new diplomacy or the new international environment, you could say. Italy's approach to the World War was probably the most amoral of the powers, And it's actually sitting on the Supreme Council of the League as some type of champion of peace and security. It had, from the onset of World War I, tried to sell its loyalty to any of the powers that it could gouge a benefit from. It had walked out of the Versailles Conference when it didn't get its claims recognised under the Treaty of London. Now, this Treaty of London was one of these secret treaties. It really typified the norms of the old imperialist diplomacy. It's similar to one of these treaties like the Sykes-Picot Accord, which is another one of these dirty secret treaties that were cooked up between the great powers. The Sykes-Picot Accord was between France and the United Kingdom, and it was executed in relation to post-war Middle East affairs. And these secret treaties were one of the bugbears of Wilson and the international peace movement. The Italian elite remained attached to the old imperialism, and in addition, so did the Japanese. The Japanese had come to Versailles looking for territorial gains, which wasn't exactly exceptional since Britain and France had that on the agenda as well. And like Italy, the World War never seemed to spark any great introspection among the Japanese ruling class. Japan's enthusiasm for the old imperialism was unchanged. And if anyone was in doubt about Japan's feelings about this, they refused to admit the League of Nations inspectors to its mandate territories after the Versailles Conference. That should have been corroboration enough that they really weren't gelling with the new diplomacy in the new international environment. The big problem, of course, but this was to come much later in the future, was Germany. The German problem does not arise, though, because it was isolated from the League. German democracy collapses in 1933, and because of that, from 1938, the international scene becomes dominated by a more aggressive German foreign policy. If I was to sort of engage in a bit of speculation, I think that only US involvement in the League may have headed off that problem. But that's dangerously hypothetical, and of course that was not the reality in 1938. If you're looking, though, I think at the source of the German problem, it's situated more accurately with the problems of the Versailles settlement and the attitude of the Allied powers to Germany in 1919, rather than a problem with the League of Nations as such. But frankly, except for the United States, the treatment of Germany is coloured or infected by chauvinistic and imperialistic thought processes of the great powers. The US, though, had different problems towards Germany, and this was largely because it was too slow to accept that the German Revolution was genuine and it needed the strongest possible support. It was sort of after sort of some proof of genuineness of the German democratic credentials. Both approaches, though, were to be in grievous error. By 1938, collective security was well and truly dead. The Abyssinian crisis, when Italy decides to invade another League of Nations member in 1935, and this was Ethiopia, showed that the League was just ineffectual. And the second Sino-Japanese War, which broke out between Japan and China in 1937, just exposes the whole organisation as being a sham. Both crises show a critical lack of will to act. This lack of will probably reflects the moral ambiguity of the two most influential great powers, France and Great Britain. Whilst, unlike the United States, they both made it to the altar, they were not enthusiastic brides for collective security. They remained far too committed to the old ways of imperialism and great power diplomacy. Both the Abyssinian and Sino-Japanese crises were also really distant and located on the periphery from European events to engage any real self-interest. But in fairness to France and Britain, who had both fought years of warfare with hideous casualties, it just seems too ridiculous to expect them to spend further blood and treasure on some distant dispute elsewhere in the world that seemed meaningless to them. I mean, you can take a conflict like the Charcot War, which is this deadly little war that occurs in the 1930s. It was between Bolivia and Paraguay. Well, it actually wasn't very little because it took out 2 or 3% of each country's population. It occurred over some desolate area that they both believed had oil. They duke it out for a few years, causing heavy casualties to each country's population. Now, could you imagine France and Britain equipping, sending, and deploying an expeditionary force to sort these two countries out? Both were active belligerents and would have been hostile opponents to the peacemakers in the middle of South America. The two countries without ports or logistical networks to support these expeditionary forces would have had to have gone head to head with both countries. Now, of course they weren't. This situation raises a complaint of how far you are morally obliged to go in sacrificing your own blood and money for other people's disputes. Now, let us consider the impact of the World War upon international affairs. Welcome back to our next part of our story. This part of our tale involves the story of a second United States president, Franklin D. Roosevelt, or as he was known by his initials, FDR. By the time World War II broke out in 1939, Roosevelt almost had two terms as president under his belt. He was re-elected to an unprecedented third term in 1940, and within a year, the United States had entered the war against both Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. Roosevelt was an entirely different proposition as president from Woodrow Wilson. He had much better political skills and was also interpersonally astute in dealing with other people. He took an initial strong interest in the shape of the post-war peace, and very early on he gave direction to the State Department to produce some ideas on how a post-war settlement might look. As the war progressed in the Allies' favour, the plans accelerated, and in this he was assisted by Summer Wells, the Under Secretary of State. Wells is sort of like Roosevelt's own Colonel House, but the relationship was very different. Wells was an avowed internationalist who oversaw the initial post-war planning, and his influence on post-war policy was to be heavy, and he enjoyed the confidence of FDR. Unlike House, though, Summer Wells was his own person, and he really didn't cower in the shadow of the president. By early 1943, Roosevelt puts the first blueprint of a new international organization to the British. The two key meetings that then shaped the future of what was to become the United Nations is the 1943 ministerial level conference in Moscow and the May 1945 formation meeting of the United Nations in San Francisco. At this point, the listener's probably saying, well, what the hell has happened here? In the last part of the podcast, the death of collective security was beyond doubt at the start of the war, and now we get its strange resurrection. I would have to agree with any listener that this was a most unexpected turn of events. At this point, the two most interesting questions seem to be, why is there a revival in collective security? And how was any hypothetical new league going to succeed where the other failed? Roosevelt's background is worth exploring to understand the first question. In his first significant public role, FDR was Woodrow Wilson's Assistant Secretary for the Navy from 1912. Roosevelt's views as a Wilsonian internationalist seem to have solidified by the time he left the Wilson administration in 1921. How genuine this remains to be seen, but throughout the 20s and the 30s, he nursed a sympathy for international peace organisation. This was not exactly a popular position at the time. A lot of the leading biographies about Roosevelt approach him with this dichotomy in mind. It's a harmonious dichotomy, but the biographers suggest that Roosevelt, he was the idealist influenced by Wilson and a realist influenced by his cousin Theodore. And the Theodore I'm talking about is the famous one, Theodore Roosevelt. He was the president of the United States at the turn of the century. And that's how these dichotomies of Roosevelt are presented. Idealist at heart, but realist by thought. Actual direct historical evidence of Roosevelt's deepest and private thoughts about an international organization are scant. Most accounts of his private thinking and decision-making are related by other sources, which is in stark contrast to Woodrow Wilson. Wilson was voluminous in his correspondence, often making his thoughts clear to different correspondents that he wrote to. One of Roosevelt's biographers quotes Frances Perkins. Frances Perkins was the first female cabinet secretary in the United States, and she was also his Secretary of Labor. She makes an interesting comment about him where she says that Roosevelt was the most complicated human being she'd ever known. He kept major decisions in his own hands, played his cards close to his chest, and enjoyed the consternation of opponents when his maneuvers were revealed. Frances Perkins was involved in public life for a very long time. She first met FDR in 1910, I think, and in that time she would have met a lot of people and some who are quite complicated, but to drop Roosevelt into that bucket of being the most complicated person she ever knew is quite revealing. And when it comes to Roosevelt, a historian should be guided by a certain wariness when they're trying to attribute motives to Roosevelt's actions. But I think it remains a strong conclusion that Roosevelt had a belief and commitment to collective security that went beyond the expedient. Therefore, the attribution that Roosevelt had a real commitment to the idea of collective security seems sustained, and it's only through his exclusive leadership that brings it back to life. And of course, Roosevelt had appointed people to his administration, like Sumner Wells and Cordell Hull, who were committed internationalists. I would have expected that in terms of his appointments, if he'd held deep reservations or was not as morally committed to collective security as I think he was, that you would have people, staff, your administration that were not as committed themselves to the idea of collective security. We now come to the second question of how was it going to succeed when the first failed? This is a much more difficult one to answer. Whether or not it would succeed was always going to be assisted by the active participation of the United States in the new international body. I think that's quite obvious because its lack of participation fatally weakened the League. So you could say that automatically, once the United States decides to be fully involved in a new international organization, it can't hurt it. It's only going to be a step forward. But getting this participation was another issue. And here Roosevelt was assisted by two things. The first lay in his superior political instincts compared to Wilson. In addition, something peculiar occurred within the Republican Party. It began to evolve into a more internationalist-based party, which seems to have been stimulated by their choice of president for the 1940 election. And these processes started to overcome the Republican resistance that hindered a US entry into the League of Nations. Some of this shift is also explained by the nature of American entry into the Second World War. The idea that America would be safe from global predators by merely isolating itself from global affairs was by 1941 completely discredited because of the Pearl Harbor attack. So, if US participation was an immediate positive, what else was going to make it work? Because it really needed more than just that. This is where Roosevelt, the Wilsonian, starts to depart, and Roosevelt, the realist, emerges. If we go back to the issues we explored in part one of the podcast, where we were pretending to be a fly on the wall at the Paris Peace Conference, the four issues that we sort of ran through as baseline issues were enforcement, dispute resolution, disarmament. And we compare what ends up in the new proposed United Nations Charter. We distinctly get the feeling that we have collective security light again, Mark II. As you will recall, I'd referred to the League of Nations in that earlier podcast as collective security light. Now, any critic in possession of their senses is going to say, well, what has exactly changed here? And superficially, you might say not much, but there are key changes from the League of Nations model, and they are very much the touches of FDR. The most radical change was in terms of the membership. Roosevelt, the realist, as opposed to the idealist, knew full well that if any progress towards a different approach to war and peace was to occur in the future, it could only be founded on great power unity. Otherwise, all other talk was just guff. Roosevelt was correct to foresee that any break in great power unanimity would render the more idealistic objectives without purpose, and collective security light was as good as it was going to get. And this is FDR's big reality check to the more idealistic advocates of collective security. Roosevelt's model also concentrated great power influence in a way that offered maximum benefits if the great powers did unite. But if the great powers did not unite over an issue, there was never going to be any collective response. Hence why the membership structure of the United Nations had the Security Council at the center of its deliberations. The proposed Security Council would have five great powers who were permanent, each with a vote and a veto, and they would be joined by temporary members who had no veto but had a vote. The General Assembly of the rest of the nations were the bulk of the membership, and these members were cut out of the enforcement slash dispute resolution aspects of the United Nations. But they were left with oversight over other less contentious issues. Roosevelt did not see the general members as having a great role in the security issues, and it would be fair to say that from his perspective, they should know their place, which was not at the table with the big players. Unfortunately, the eventual onset of the Cold War reinforced Roosevelt's reality check. If you had no unanimity, the United Nations would be sidelined anyway. But as I said, there was sufficient structure in place so that if the big players did unite, then the sky was the limit. Sanctions, compulsory arbitration, or war making could all be imposed upon an aggressor. And we get the best example of this in the history of the United Nations during the first Gulf War in 1990, when Iraq invaded Kuwait. But any critic would note that this was almost 50 years after the formation of the United Nations. And it's here that we get to the definitive answer to the second question, which is that nothing in the new United Nations was guaranteed to succeed. But it had sufficient architecture and flexibility if political circumstances changed. And this also allowed additional scope for action where there was no great power rivalry. And you see this to a degree in the Congo during the early 1960s. So we get an answer to our two key questions. And so we will now move on to consider how collective security was assimilated into global practice. Welcome back to this chapter. As we commence this next part, what will become strikingly obvious is the domination of America in the discussion. It's by no coincidence that the 20th century was referred to as the American century, but it's certainly true. The 20th century was the American century. And so for all those non-Americans out there who are a little bit sad about the unbalanced nature of the discussion, no apologies really can be made. It's the reality that America reaches peak power by the time the Soviet Union disintegrates in 1991. The San Francisco Conference in May 1945 forms the United Nations. Roosevelt, like Wilson before him, though, would suffer from the vagaries of ill health, and he would die only weeks before the United Nations foundational meeting in April 1945. Fortunately for Roosevelt, his successor, Harry S. Truman, was committed to internationalism and collective security, and the work by the United States in setting up the post-war settlement and the machinery was not to be wasted. And as Truman settled into the presidency, collective security becomes official US policy as Truman is able to cement its place in American foreign policy over his almost 8-year period as president. A bit more about this later, because a brief point needs to be made around the issue of nuclear weapons. As we would be well aware, in 1945, the United States drops two atomic weapons on Japan, and we are now at the onset of the nuclear age. Nuclear weapons, though, exert pressures on foreign policy and collective security in a way that wasn't envisaged by the 19th century or early 20th century theorists on the issue. You could theoretically take a rogue power, either a great power, that's on the outer with all the other powers, or something more like a middle-level power in possession of an arsenal of nuclear weapons. The fact that the power has these weapons, possesses these weapons, restrains the ability of the other states, the opposing states, to deal with this rogue nuclear power in a way that wasn't imagined by anyone before World War II. Nuclear weapons tend to break the original logic around collective security simply because weapons of mass destruction like nuclear armaments, they pervert the process of putting a rogue power under collective pressure. So, for example, let's say power X is told to give up something under threat of conventional attack by a collection of nations. If power X says you can stick that idea, its counter reply is magnified by the threat of its nuclear arsenal. Whether it even threatens to do it or not, the fact that it has it and people know they have it, the threat is implicit. To some degree, Russia's been mimicking this type of behaviour since 2014, though that's a little different from the example I give of Power X, because Russia has other things going for it. Like, it's not completely diplomatically isolated. It still has friends. And, of course, its best friend is a nuclear power in its own right, which is China. And there's no real answer to this problem in collective security except to go back to the early first principles expressed by the peace movement in the 19th century, that disarmament or arms reduction promotes the strongest possible environment for collective security to work. Just to return to our main narrative, I alluded to earlier that the United Nations was effectively sidelined by the Cold War, but the early 1990s thaw allows for a revival of sorts with some type of great power unity. You get approximately about 5 years of this great power unity, and then it dissipates. Civil wars scatter the whole post-war period, and their frequency increases so much that they dwarf the number of interstate wars in the period. And it's interesting that civil wars were not really ever contemplated as matters falling within the purview of collective security, which is probably because of their rarity before 1945. But civil wars since 1945 have both increased in number and have been incredibly brutal. And collective security as a framework is at a serious disadvantage in dealing with civil wars. There are two big reasons for that. One obvious reason is the real aggressor is hard to sometimes identify. I mean, in normal interstate conflicts too, the real aggressor can be difficult to identify as well. We're still debating who is to blame for causing World War I. And that's not by any means resolved 111 years later. And in addition, civil wars have been underlined by genuine grievances rather than the typically politically sordid reasons that might motivate great power rivalry. An intervention in that circumstance may be problematic if the purpose is to simply keep the peace. That's what collective security is about. It's about keeping the peace. I mean, you could just imagine trying to have a international peace organization intervene into the American Civil War. I mean, we want to keep the peace, do we? We want to preserve slavery. Those are the types of issues that any international organization sometimes faces with civil wars. Head-to-head great power conflict, though, was rarer in the latter half of the 20th century. And a very adventurous observer might argue this was due to the collective security framework. I think that claim is not sustainable. If you are looking for perhaps reasons why there is not so much head-to-head great power conflict, the presence of nuclear weapons is a more compelling reason for that explanation. In addition, the great powers really require a need to respond to something if they are to enact and initiate conflict. The absence of a threat is not the same thing as trying to cope with an ongoing threat. Just because you have an absence of a threat doesn't mean that the world has become safer because of collective security. One need only consider the fate of a man on a deserted island. Does a man suddenly become a convert to asexuality or celibacy just because there are no people on his deserted island that he's stuck on with no other living creature in sight? Of course not. Claims of success for collective security based on this type of absence evidence should get the same treatment as those relating to our deserted island friend. We also must consider how American internal political dynamics affect collective security and how it's delivered. And these are important, and they've brought about different approaches by different presidents. For example, some presidents have been more orientated towards a multilateral type of diplomacy than other presidents. With the conclusion of Truman's presidency and the ascension of Eisenhower, 20 years of Democratic Party control of the White House ends. And Eisenhower, though, continues collective security as policy. But the contrast with his vice president at the time and his later successor, Richard Nixon, was very different. Nixon, as the first Republican president after Eisenhower, reflected a drift away from collective security. There was no outright abandonment of collective security, but Nixon and his main foreign policy advisor, Henry Kissinger, were much more heavily influenced by traditional balance of power considerations and realist views of foreign policy. And the Republican drift just increased after Nixon. In the 80s, you started to get a lot of direct criticism of the United Nations, and it became entrenched in the Republican Party. And there were some minor unilateral deviations by the United States when it chose to invade the island of Grenada in 1983 and the 1989 Panama campaign. But the real climax is the coming of the Second Gulf War and the invasion of Iraq in 2003. And this, of course, is the famous weapons of mass destruction excuse that causes the United States to invade. The Republican drift from collective security may, in fact, have been, though, the most honest approach in foreign policy since 1945. Here we are in 2025, Israel's war against Iran, Russia's war against the Ukraine, and what have we got to show for over 100 years of collective security? Not much, by the look of it. In 2025, the truest appreciation of collective security is that it's still an aspiration, regardless of how clever FDR's reforms were. And whilst it might be fashionable to tut tut about Nixon, Reagan, and Bush, they may have been drinking far less of the Kool-Aid than others were. Note that I don't mention Trump in this equation, despite being sorely tempted to comment on Trump foreign policy. Aside from the historical reality of failure, a number of criticisms can be made that on a theoretical basis, the system of collective security itself may, in fact, create instability in various ways. I don't want to step into situations that are not really historically tested here, but when you read some of these ideas, they are quite logically persuasive. For example, Richard K. Betts, in his article Systems for Peace or Causes of War, stated, among other things, that equalizing military power for individual states through arms control without reference to their possible alignment later on in a war might yield unequal forces when those possible alignments eventually come together. I think he uses the term congeal, when the alignments congeal. Those aren't the only criticisms that Betts makes in his article. They also include quite an insightful remark that collective security seems to appear at coincidental points in history after really major conflicts, because the scale of the conflict appears to make peace appear normal, and that this is actually a bit of a distorted thinking process. Peace may not be normal given the prolific number of conflicts throughout history. And of course, you only need to look at the civil conflicts that have been going on since 1945 across the whole globe to have that reinforced as a point. But these big, big wars can lead to the belief that peace is the more normal state of affairs, when it's actually not. And that when you engage in this collective security process, motivated by the ferocity of a large war, you are kind of denying the reality of geopolitics and perhaps even that old chestnut, human nature. Now, as we reach the end of this section of the podcast and really, really get close to the end, I will just make one brief mention of Donald Trump and foreign policy. I am not sure whether President Trump actually understands what policy is in the public administration understanding of the term, why you make it, why you have it. And I am not sure whether Trump has any real understanding of what collective security would be or its opposing concept. This may make Trump's response to a real crisis, a really dangerous crisis, which he didn't have in his first term, to be quite unpredictable. This now brings us to the final part of our podcast. Commencing this conclusion reminds me of a quote from Arnold Wolfers, the Swiss international relations scholar, who said this in 1962. Promotion of the idea of collective security has created a psychological situation in which the United States cannot turn its back on the concept, not because of what collective security can accomplish, but because of what millions of people believe it may accomplish in time. Collective security has come to be the chief symbol of hope that a community of nations will develop in which there will be no more war. The key task for the historian often boils down to two directions. What is the shifting phenomena, and why do things stay the same? Or more succinctly, change and continuity. What are the change factors and what are the continuity factors? And when we come to answering this fundamental historical question, what are the change factors encouraging the process of alteration, and what are the continuity factors for preserving the status quo? And with collective security, it seems to be that the key change factors in international relations were the First and the Second World Wars. The novelty or the depth of how traumatic these conflicts were motivated a good deal of the change factors, promoting a movement away from the balance of power model. But what has tended to prevent a full shift, and these are of course our continuity factors, and what's seemed to have allowed a balance of power model to essentially still coexist beneath the veneer of collective security has been the nation-state slash sovereignty structure of global politics. And it seems like that the nation-state and sovereignty, these institutions give significant ongoing support to the current structure remaining the status quo. In 2025, collective security, like it was in 1919 and 1945, is an aspiration. It's not a completed reality, and it may never will be. In part one, we saw how the First World War created the opportunity for an idealist American president to make collective security the centerpiece of geopolitical stability. And that process ended in failure when the Second World War broke out. Another American president attempted the same, but with a more realistic approach. And the balance of the evidence since 1945 is that we've not reached the point where collective security is an effective stabilizing mechanism in international relations. Franklin Roosevelt foresaw that unless there was a radical change in how nations approached geopolitical affairs, the United Nations wouldn't work. If you didn't have great power unity, it would fail. And that is really what we're waiting for with collective security, is for there to be some radical change. But is that just a fool's paradise? And the thinking that emanated from the Republican Party reflected a more realistic approach to how geopolitical affairs actually worked. With that final thought, that now brings us to the end of Studies in Foreign Policy, Collective Security, Part 2. Thank you for listening, and by all means, catch up with our other podcasts. If you have any questions or comments, please send them to crowdtalks, CROWDTALKS, all one word, at proton.me. And we hope that you enjoyed listening to it as much as we enjoyed making it. Once again, thank you for listening, and goodbye.